Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up later in today's program, we've got Culture Couch and Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. Miami Valley officials are only beginning to calculate the long-term impacts of the devastation from the Memorial Day tornado outbreak. Key is an investigation by FEMA to determine whether Ohio is eligible for emergency aid. Officials caution it's a complicated process that will take time. To see it in action, WISO's April Leslie followed one FEMA team into a hard-hit area of Trotwood.
At the Westbrook Village apartment complex, a group of investigators walk through muddy grass holding clipboards, taking stock of what's left.
It's hard to tell from down here, but you can see all the roof damage and things sticking up. Like they had a tarp over.
Oh, yep.
And I'm assuming it was like a tree that entered the roof or something.
Roof damage is just one of the problems here. The building is missing almost all of its windows. Insulation and drywall sit in piles on the lawn. This complex originally had 312 units. Now, only 72 of them are habitable. In just a few days, this FEMA team will assess these apartments and survey the rest of the damage all over the county. The Montgomery County Emergency Management Agency estimates over 2,500 properties suffered some kind of storm damage. Jay Carey, with the county EMA, says investigators are trying to figure out what it'll take for the community to recover, not just by looking at the buildings, but by talking to the residents.
Trying to get an idea of the impact, not just in dollars. Keep in mind, it's uninsured damage we're looking at as well.
Many of the people who lived in this complex didn't have renter's insurance. That'll factor into FEMA's overall assessment, Carey says. The agency is expected to finish surveying the damage across Ohio this week. For WISO, I'm April Leslie.
And thousands of property owners affected by the tornado disaster could be eligible for a break in their 2020 tax bills. The auditors in Greene and Montgomery County are urging people with storm-damaged property to apply for help under a state tax relief program. WISO's Jess Mador has this story.
Officials are still working to assess the impact of the storm. Preliminary estimates show at least 3,500 homes and businesses were damaged across Mercer, Greene, and Montgomery counties. Throughout the summer, assessors are expected to canvass neighborhoods documenting home and business values. Montgomery County Auditor Carl Keith says the state's tax relief program is designed to help property owners recover from the disaster.
And so this is going to have an impact on people, and their home is their greatest investment in a lot of cases, and so this is going to have a long-standing impact on people who have been displaced, people who have lost everything.
Keith says property owners with tornado damage should apply for a tax reduction as soon as possible. Forms are available at county auditors' offices by mail or online. Any reductions would show up next year on property owners' first half 2020 tax bills. For WISO, I'm Jess Mador.
Organizations helping with relief efforts from the Memorial Day tornadoes gathered at Sinclair Community College on Friday morning to discuss how to take those efforts to the next level.
I want my people to come back home. Amen. Because the city of Trotwood is a family.
Amen. Thank you so much.
Just one of the many speakers expressing their thoughts at the meeting convened by local health, social service, and faith-based groups with help from Ohio Governor Mike DeWine's office. Officials from Dayton, Beaver Creek, Trotwood, and Harrison Township gave updates on how their communities were doing almost 2 weeks after the tornadoes. Caleb Ingram is with Declare Dayton, an organization that works to unify the outreach efforts of local churches. He says Dayton has been put to the test because of the tornadoes and a rally that took place just days before the storms.
Either one of those could have divided a city or could have damaged the city irreparably. But what's encouraging to me is in both cases, we saw the greater Dayton community stand together and say, this is who we are, this is what we believe in, that we're for one another. We as a city, regardless of any emergency, are committed to rise above the challenges around us, whether that's economic, whether that's opioids, whether that's a KKK group, or whether that's tornadoes, that we're moving forward, and you can't put us down.
Dayton native Daquana Farrow, a community activist involved with several local churches, says the Friday meeting focused on next steps for recovery and how organizations can further serve those affected by the storms.
The reality of it is that readiness is huge. I think that's one of the areas where we definitely have an opportunity for improvement. And I think having seen and witnessed this disaster really gives us a more sense of urgency around doing that.
Participating organizations said there will be a follow-up meetings and vowed to remain focused on helping residents displaced by the storms. The coalition's efforts can be followed on social media under the hashtag DaytonStrong. We also want to let you know that social service organizations are warning that post-traumatic stress is a very real concern for many people affected by the tornadoes that ripped through the Miami Valley. Bonnie Parrish is the executive director for Family Services, a mental health agency operating in Dayton for more than 100 years.
We were here during the flood of 1913, the cholera outbreak, and almost anything that you could imagine that's happened since. So we are familiar with disasters.
Parrish told us, following a disaster, people will often focus on their immediate needs, including shelter, food, and safety, without processing the emotional trauma of the experience.
You know, many people are going to get through this, and they're resilient. They're going to come back, and they're going to say, this was a disaster, and we survived it, and they're going to be okay. And they'll process it. It's when you get stuck in that process. We see it can happen anywhere from, you know, the next day to, it could be a year or two.
Parrish urges anyone experiencing emotional trauma to seek help. The American Red Cross Dayton chapter says they are increasing their focus on emotional trauma as part of the recovery effort. That, in addition to continuing bulk food distribution and the operation of a shelter, displaced residents under the care of the Red Cross have been relocated to Bethesda Temple on Salem Avenue as those shelter numbers began dropping last week. And looking further at the mental health side of things, rural America has high rates of chronic disease. The more remote a community, the more heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. And there's a side effect many people don't think about: depression, anxiety, even suicide. This is especially true for older adults. Side Effect Public Media's Lisa Gillespie reports from Casey County, Kentucky, 2 hours south of Louisville.
There's a long one-story house that comes up quick, right after a pretty big curve in the road. There I meet
Dennis Pond, P-O-N-D, like a fishing pond.
He asks me to pardon the mess. He and his wife, Gay, collect things, like a pizza cutter in the shape of a bicycle, an antique fishing reel, old photos. I'm here to talk with Dennis about his chronic health problems. In 2006, he was in the hospital because of a bad case of pneumonia, and
the doctor asked me, he said, Mr. Pond, he said, how long have you been a diabetic? And I didn't know I was a diabetic, so.
Oh, really?
So I could have been a diabetic for most of my life and didn't know it.
Now he has severe nerve damage in his feet. And Gay says Dennis's doctor
said he's a prime candidate for to have his feet taken off.
Yeah.
Amputation is a sign that diabetes hasn't been well controlled. It's almost always preventable. And it's a result of blood supply slowly being cut off, what he describes as 1,000 needles on the bottom of his feet.
The pain gets so bad sometimes that I actually feel like either cutting my own feet off or just taking care of myself, if you know what I mean by that. I mean, ending it.
Mental illness and thoughts of suicide are hidden issues for many people with chronic disease. It doesn't get talked about a lot, but emerging research shows it's a big problem. In a follow-up call, Dennis confirms that this whole situation with his diabetes, along with blood clots and a bad back, it makes him depressed. Just a few years ago, he was involuntarily committed to a state mental hospital after trying to kill himself.
Well, I think when a person has a lot of pain in their life, you know, it causes them to go into depression.
Yeah.
And it makes them feel suicidal because they feel like they're useless. So they want to just, you know, do away with it.
Yeah. That's what some people call deaths of despair.
These are kind of mortality causes that are associated with hopelessness.
Michael Meat heads the NORC Center for Rural Health Analysis in Chicago. He says these are deaths from a drug overdose or related to alcohol or by suicide. Suicide rates in 2017 were 30% higher in Appalachia than the rest of the country. And within the region, suicides were concentrated in
so eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, eastern Tennessee.
Meat says it's not a coincidence that these areas have high rates of chronic disease. Other factors also play in, like the loss of jobs. Gina Piani was one of the first researchers to start putting two and two together. She's a professor at National University in California. In 2014, she published a study on people with chronic conditions and their feelings.
As you have more chronic conditions, you also are more likely to report psychological distress. And those are correlated with depression and with suicide ideation as well.
Piani says the answer is preventing these diseases by giving young people more health and nutrition education. Psychologist John Fulton has another solution for the people he sees at an outpatient clinic about 30 miles from Pond's house. He tries to teach people coping skills.
And I try to say, you know, you're sitting there focusing on the bad things, and all that's going to do is drag you down deeper. And try to get them to turn around and start thinking about, well, I'll go outside and look at dogs, or I'll watch wrestling on TV or something.
Dennis does have a good support system in his wife. He and Gay married in 2013 after he did work on her house.
The first kiss was like a little pick. And I said, no, that ain't the way to do it. Let me show you how to do it.
Well, that's the first date.
And so we started going together. She's my wife and she's my friend.
And there might be hope for Dennis's pain. He's likely going to get surgery that would increase blood flow in his feet. I'm Lisa Gillespie in Louisville.
Side Effects Public Media is a news collaborative covering public health in the Midwest. I'm Jerry Kenney. You're listening to WISO Weekend on WISO. Thanks for joining us. Farmers in Ohio and many other parts of the country are rushing to get their crops planted after a long, wet spring. The late start means many acres intended for corn won't get planted, and farmers are running far behind on soybeans as well. WOSU's Nick Evans visited some Central Ohio farms for a progress report.
The last time I visited Brett Davis's farm in Delaware County, I was asking him about a program helping farmers bit by the trade war. It was raining then, and it was pretty wet when I spoke to him this week, too.
Even yesterday, it had been wet for the past few days.
It was terrible yesterday. It's the worst conditions I've planted in. I mean, I shouldn't have been there. I really shouldn't have.
Davis and his team were out past 1 a.m. the night before, trying to get seeds planted ahead of more rain. He's two-thirds done with corn and about a third of the way through with soybeans. He's still pretty optimistic they'll be able to make up for lost time, but Davis is realistic about this year's crop.
A corn plant and a soybean plant is nothing but a solar panel. It takes every bit of sunlight it can and the nutrients to make what it does, and when we're a month behind, you've cut a month of growing out of a season that's fairly short to start with.
The USDA's latest crop progress report paints a stark portrait. Ohio's farmers have only planted a fifth of their acreage intended for soybeans. Last year, they'd completed 80% by now. Farmers are further along with corn, planting slightly more than a third of what they did last year. But they've also passed the cutoff for federal crop insurance. Anything they plant after June 5th gets steadily less coverage.
We have that field left to go. We will probably plant past the deadline.
A few miles away, Ryan Rhodes is trying to sow up the last of his planting.
And we put nearly 300 acres in the past 2 days. That would have been Tuesday and Wednesday. So we really made a big push on some ground that maybe we shouldn't have, but the acres are planted, and we'll see what happens with germination.
And the late start is only contributing to an already stressful situation. In addition to the ongoing trade war, a report from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, shows an uptick in people falling behind on farm loan payments. But Brian Ricker, CEO of the lending co-op Ag Credit, isn't raising alarms just yet.
We haven't seen that quite as much. You know, within our portfolio, our delinquencies are a little higher than what they were a few years ago, but just they're still very, very manageable. And, overall, the lenders, the banks and the farm credit system, we're very, very well capitalized.
It's been a bit drier south of Columbus on Scott Metzger's farm. But like Davis and Rhodes, he's been rushing to catch up.
We started then and had about a five, six-day window till Memorial Day there. And we ran pretty hard those days and were able to get quite a bit done in that amount of time. So we're just down to a little bit here left. So in a day, we can get finished up with what we have.
Metzger's farm is done with corn, and they're finishing up on beans, too. He takes me to their last field, where his cousin Blake is running the planter. Even here, there are broad swaths of standing water cutting across the rows.
this bank you can plant close to the water. That one running through the middle of the field, you won't be able to get as close. And on the other side of that, you won't be able to get as close either. It's a little more gravelly on this side, but you get on that side, it's a little...
Despite the late start and the late nights catching up, Metzger, Rhodes, and Davis are all thankful to be squeaking in at least close to the deadline. All three have heard from farmers in northern Ohio who haven't even begun planting. Those farmers can get limited compensation through federal crop insurance. Metzger thinks in the Midwest, the number of people making those prevented planting claims could reach a record this year. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Coming up on Why So Weekend, we've got Culture Couch and Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. Up first, lawmakers and dozens of opponents to a pro-gun bill squared off in an Ohio House committee over so-called constitutional carry. The measure allows anyone to carry a concealed weapon without the need for a permit or training. State House correspondent Andy Chow filed this report.
Amy Whitson is a trauma surgeon who teaches advanced trauma life support in Columbus. She says she's seen firsthand the serious and fatal effects of gun violence through the patients to which she's tended.
House Bill 178 would permit more people to carry out violent acts such as this.
The bill would allow permitless concealed carry, scrapping the state's requirements for a person to receive 8 hours of training and to obtain a permit in order to carry a concealed weapon. Pro-gun groups have said this is an important constitutional issue to allow someone to carry a concealed weapon without going through additional hurdles such as training. Republican Representative Ron Hood of Asheville is a sponsor of the bill. He takes issue with Whitson's claim that it would mean more violence.
Can you explain to me or show me in House Bill 178 how it permits people to carry out violent acts?
So, by releasing needing a permit to carry a concealed weapon, more people will be able to carry concealed weapons into buildings, into schools, and commit violent acts. It's a direct line.
But Hood argues the flaw in that perspective is that someone who wants to carry out a violent act is not waiting for the permit laws to change.
Can you explain to me how a criminal is going through that process in their mind that I'm going to go murder somebody, But House Bill 178 didn't become law, so I just can't, I'm not going to be able to take my gun in there and commit that violent act.
Along with permitless concealed carry, the bill would also remove the requirement for an armed person to tell a police officer that they're carrying a weapon. Law enforcement groups are also opposing the bill because of the changes it makes to the notification requirement. Democratic Representative Fred Strayhorn says the general notion with permits and training is to require more responsibility to come with gun ownership or concealed carry.
This bill makes it somewhat harder for law enforcement to distinguish between who may be have good intent and who may have bad intent. And a lot of violence happens in a very fluid motion. Everything's not premeditated.
Matthew Euculus is a recent graduate of Walnut Hills High School in Cincinnati. He insists there should be more gun restrictions, not less. He shared the story of his cousin, Jamie Guttenberg, who was killed in the mass school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Euculus references a statistic from Stanford Law researchers that found states with weaker carry permit laws end up seeing an increase of gun violence by 13-15%. Republican Representative Kyle Kaler, a co-sponsor of the bill, takes issue with the statistics that are brought up when it comes to gun violence. For example, questioning of the numbers might include suicides.
Suicide is horrible. Gun violence is horrible. But to somehow relate it to concealed carry laws, that doesn't mean anything in relationship to this particular bill.
Euculus disagrees, saying the data is reliable proof.
I think if it's 15%, that's a clear causation. That is a major increase in violent crime rates. There's a clear causation in that scenario.
Strayhorn adds that there might be certain scenarios of gun violence that don't necessarily align directly with the requirement for a permit, but says making Ohio a permitless carry state can strike the wrong tone.
We can do things that encourage people to be more responsible, to seek training, to delay the perhaps the purchase or the carrying of a firearm that gives them a moment to think.
This bill has been introduced several times in the Ohio General Assembly, but may have more momentum this year as more states pass similar laws. Andy Chow at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us. In the last several years, many more transgender and non-binary artists have emerged onto the American cultural scene. Recently, Earl M. College, 50 miles west of Dayton, held a gathering for singers called the Transgender Singing Voice Conference. It brought together about 200 music educators, composers, and transgender and non-binary singers from all over the U.S. Community Voices producer David Seitz brings us that story.
A choir director at Earl M. College was the main organizer of the conference. Her name is Daniel Cozart Steele, and she told me a story about one of her choir members, a member of the bass section.
She said, well, actually, I would like to start coming to class dressed in women's clothing. This is how I feel the most comfortable, and I'm hoping for your support.
Choir director Cozart Steele uses the name Charlotte for her student. At first, Charlotte only wore dresses during rehearsals. A few months later, she began to go out with choir members dressed as a female. Then Charlotte made another request.
She came back to me and she said, well, now I would like to sing in the alto section rather than in the bass section so that my social function as an alto and the voice part that I am singing aligns with who I am as a human being.
Charlotte had no upper register to sing alto, so Cozart Steele coached Charlotte to broaden her range to comfortably sing strong alto parts. One day, they hit a roadblock.
Her voice was cracking and popping. She was having trouble initiating sound, and her range had gotten smaller. And I was really perplexed. And so we sat down and talked, and she had had a discussion with her mom. And her mom had challenged her gender identity, and that was directly reflected in her ability to use her voice.
Bill Culverhouse, a choral director at SUNY Binghamton, who led a workshop at the conference, explains this intertwining of voice and identity.
Your voice is a way of channeling into sound who you are, what you strive for, what you dream.
Over the past 6 years, vocal educators have come to challenge the assumptions of choral singing, that men sing bass and women sing alto.
Everybody actually has this wider vocal compass available to them, but that we are socialized into only using a narrower portion of it, especially in choir.
In one workshop, Culverhouse led students through a tenor line that glides from upper to lower register. Eli Berman also presented at the conference. Berman, a student at Princeton University, identifies as non-binary.
I'm always bumping up against other people's ideas of what my voice means. And my falsetto is just like, oh, like I can sing alto if you want. It's fun, you know. But then realizing, no, like this is my whole voice, and this is all of it, and this is all of me.
Berman now composes and sings vocal works that explore body, voice, and identity. This piece borrows from the styles of Jewish cantoral singing. Other trans composers are thinking about what inclusion means for choirs. Michael Buswitz-Quorm, who identifies as female, has created the Coral Reef Project. It calls for choirs to improvise parts of the work.
Their voice is part of their transition, so exploring their voice also helps. It can only help them. The other members of the choir are interacting one-on-one with trans singers. You know, they're given permission through experimentation of this.
Buswitz-Quorm, who chooses to use male pronouns, grew up with a chronic illness and a crushed vertebrae that required multiple surgeries and relearning to walk. He felt removed from the world.
but I was, you know, physiologically a boy, emotionally a girl. And, you know, so where did I fit in? And, you know, music was a place where I fit in.
Busowitz Quorum struggled with his body and gender until late in his life.
There was this growing level of dissonance inside me, a dissonant void. That should be the name of my next choral piece. There was a certain point where I felt like I needed to find peace within.
The music educators, composers, and singers at this conference are making room for new voices in choirs across the country.
We're all going through transitions, and the more we can support each other, you know, the stronger we are.
For Culture Couch, this is David Seitz.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. For the second week of early summer, the first week of the milkweed beetle mating moon, the third week of the sun in Gemini. I keep a notebook of things I see around me, and I often see that the past feeds my present and gives me a sense of stability. Reliving certain times in the woods offers me a sense of permanence. I can read that such and such a thing took place, that this took place, this was. The experience will vanish with my ability to remember, to read or write, but still, I go back now, making that past the present this time. Like June 4th of 2017, I wrote, "The black mulberries are falling so quickly, and I see entire boughs collapsed into yards and streets so heavy with their sweet, soft fruit." Or on June 4th of 2015, I wrote, "Robins continue to guide their young with steady, intense calls. Sparrow fledglings sit by the bird feeder, flap their wings to beg for food." On the 4th of June in 1999, we drove from western New York to Bar Harbor, Maine, and I wrote, "We left early summer behind, climbing into May. We saw bleeding hearts in New Hampshire. Lower Maine was full of sweet locust flowers, full bloom by the time we reached Augusta. East to Bar Harbor, there were parsnips and hemlocks and wild roses and blackberry flowers and wild pink roses. And middle spring was gathering momentum the farther north we went." So here today, June 4th, 2019, I think about repetition and repeating observations of each day, year after year. And I understand how the more I see, the more each day seen becomes. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of early summer and the second week of the milkweed beetle mating moon. In the meantime, well, look for some milkweed and milkweed beetles, and you'll remember that in years to come.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.